You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Kevin Peters for the past 2 hours. But now at 12 p.m, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly duck dive and weave through the latest cinema releases. Which films are going to show you a good time and which are simply after your money? My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show this morning are Jenny Colley.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Morning.
Jim Ross.
Hello.
And Owen Baker.
Hello.
Today's show starts in the stars and ends with Tales from the Riverbank. Star Trek Into Darkness finds the crew of the starship Enterprise up against Benedict Cumberbatch's merciless man on a mission. Pedro Almodovar takes a breather from making melodramatic masterpieces for the mile-high sexual shenanigans of comedy I'm So Excited. Noomira Pace has revenge on her mind when she teams up with Colin Farrell's secretive gangster in Dead Men Down, the Hollywood debut of Girl with a Dragon Tattoo director Niels Arden Oplev. And Matthew McConaughey is the mysterious man found living high in a tree in the southern tale of Mud, the latest from Take Shelter director Jeff Nichols. Plus, we have the second of our two pieces from this year's Watersprite International Student Film Festival, with Bums on Seats regular Sarah McIntosh talking to cinematographer Gabby Norland about the help on hand for female filmmakers from the Women in Film and TV organisation. That's all to come, but we'll begin the show by splitting our infinitives.
You think you can't make mistakes? But the choices you make could get yourself and everyone under your command killed. But I believe in you, Jim. Darkness is coming. You are a pawn, Kirk.
Sir, there's a ship heading right for us.
You can't even guarantee the safety of your own crew. Now, shall we begin? I'm sorry.
Though it seems a surefire thing now, there was no actual guarantee the 2009 reboot of Star Trek would succeed after all the 10 previous films, the last of which had been in 2002, had reduced the crew of the Starship Enterprise into a directionless joke and ill-fitting uniforms. But with the help of some swashbuckle stolen from Star Wars and clever casting, director J.J. Abrams made what had always been the most po-faced of space operas into a light-on-its-feet frolic. The sequel, Star Trek Into Darkness, which opened earlier this week, attempts more of the same, whilst facing the usual problems of a second film, expanding the universe, deepening the characters and relationships, and upping the ante when it comes to the action. The movie opens with Kirk still learning on the hoof how to captain the Starship Enterprise, recklessly breaking the prime directive in order to save Spock. His hubris is punished with demotion, though an act of terrorism in London, followed by an attack on the Starfleet headquarters in San Francisco, soon places him back in the captain's chair. He and his crew, Sulu, Uhura, Chekhov and Simon Pegg Scotty, are sent on a risky mission to track down ex-Starfleet officer John Harrison, who is deemed responsible for the attacks. But Harrison, played with the unerring gaze of a cultured snake by Benedict Cumberbatch, proves to be more than a match for Kirk and his crew. Jenny, everybody's seen this, but I'll come to you first. the first Star Trek 2 or 3 years ago succeeded because J.J. Abrams found a mix between not taking the legacy of this decades-old brand too seriously, but also not laughing at it or making fun of it. Does he pull off this difficult balancing act again?
I think he definitely does. I think there's a lot of notes in the movie that reward long-time Star Trek fans. But likewise, if you've never seen any Star Trek before in your life except the first movie, you'd probably hugely enjoy this. And I don't think it impedes your viewing in any way to not get the little side jokes, little Bones quotes and so on. I think it was a great film, lots of explosions and fun, really. I loved it.
Jim, is that enough? A rollicking good time is what everybody's after in a summer blockbuster, and it's what we had 2 weeks ago with a quite excellent Iron Man 3. But is that enough for a Star Trek film with a legacy of not seriousness, but themes that the TV show in its various incarnations had? Is it enough just to simply to have be a rollicking good adventure?
For me, no. I mean, I'm not going to say I disliked it, because, you know, I had some fun watching it. A lot of the action's quite good, if not particularly inspired in my book, but it was quite good fun. But for me, it did need more. I mean, what made the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek work was that relationship between Kirk and Spock. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on, but for me, that was the interesting bit. Here, it takes a bit of a back seat. Themes are thrown up left, right, and centre, and none are developed. It falls into the same trap that I think Super 8 did, in that the film doesn't finish. For a film that's just over 2 hours long, it really felt like a rushed ending to me, and it doesn't really feel like it did end. Whilst at the same time not offering any particularly obvious routes towards a sequel, so it's not as if it was even a particularly cliffhangery ending. It needed more. A lot of the action was quite good. But
you don't watch Star Trek for the action.
Well, no. The thing is, like, you do have a point there, and I think that quite a lot of what people really liked about Star Trek back in the day has been jettisoned. But to be honest with you, I kind of think that happened with the first one. Albeit he did have that central relationship to fall back on and make it interesting. So, yes, I think that's true. But on the other hand, I think if you've seen the first one, I'm not convinced why we thought it would necessarily be particularly different this time around. For me, it needed more. There wasn't enough character development, there wasn't enough theme development. It was just, albeit very impressive, bangs and explosions.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, in that you were willing to excuse the first film's lazy writing. It doesn't have a proper third act, and it falls a little bit too far back on being referential to the series. But you were willing to forgive that because the cast was so good, and because the relationship between Kirk and the new Kirk and the new Spock worked well. It's disappointing when this film starts that we're once again... in a way, this really is just... It's like Iron Man 2 in many respects. It's replaying the same themes as the first film. They're all bickering again. They're all not getting on...
But are also doing it less well.
It's less like watching the Starship Enterprise and more like the Big Brother house. There's no reason why any of these people should get on. Dave, I know you enjoyed it certainly more than me, but most people would have done. But is there away from how spectacular it looks, away from the sound design and the special effects...
And the lens flare,
which...
There was less, though.
Not sure about that. Continue.
Does it do anything with the themes? Is there any reason to... watch this other than that? Does it take these characters any further, or does it just put them back at square one and let them walk ahead again?
There's a little bit of the development. It's quite nice. There's a good bit early on in the father-son relationship between Bruce Greenwood's character, whose name, the Admiral, who was the original captain of the Enterprise, Pike, thank you, and Chris Pine. See, Pine and Pike, they sound too similar. Pine's Kirk. So between Pike and Kirk, it's very nice at the beginning, and they play on the whole father-son. The fact that in the first movie, Kirk was directionless, and then Pike shows up and gives him a purpose. And then he almost comes back at the beginning to say, "Oi, you have gone back to square one. Sharpen up. Get on with it."
But is that believable when he's captaining a starship? He's not in the academy.
He's not. That's the trouble. Because of the way he has been acting, they take it away from him at the start of the movie. Then, of course, Benedict Cumberbatch shows up, and everything goes to amazing, perfect hell, basically. And it's right, we need Kirk again because he's the only one who can fly the ship.
because we've conveniently killed everybody else who possibly yes. could. And they sort of backed the character into a corner there. Owen, what about... There's so many things wrong with this book. it's away from the rollicking good adventure. I want you to pick some holes in the internal logic, because I think this film is particularly lazy, even for a sequel. And again, it's not helped by the fact it's followed Iron Man 3, which is an excellent sequel that builds and expands and treats the writing like a special effect in and of itself. This Star Trek film, whilst it is fun, it's terribly lazy. It's really just a template. It's like it's been traced over an earlier Star Trek. It's basically a tracing of Wrath of Khan, really.
Yeah. I think it's a difficult film to review in some ways, because I think a sort of similar problem to the other guys who have struggled with is that I quite enjoyed it. I didn't come out thinking that was rubbish or anything like that, but I do think all of those problems exist. And, you know, as someone who, when I was growing up, watched... I'm not a Trekkie, because that's the sort of thing that follows you around, isn't it? But, I quite liked Star Trek when I was growing up, and I felt like... You asked Jenny at the start, has this, you know, with the sort... Is it referential enough to the originals and stuff like that? And I feel like it's just thrown all of the original stuff away in order to make a sort of rollicking good time. And like Jim says, I don't think that is enough, and I do think the ending is incredibly rushed, and I think loads of the internal logic is flawed. You know, there's some things that happen here which just, even with a sort of tertiary knowledge of Star Trek, just wouldn't happen. And I have, you know, the spot. I think you're absolutely right. Basically, I think they've just reset to the start of the first one, the first reboot, if you like, and they've just done it again, worse. And they've still come out because they're very proficient filmmakers. They've still come out with something that's perfectly enjoyable. You can sit there. I'm astonished that people who really like Star Trek like this as much as they do. I would have thought people who'd never seen Star Trek would go in and go, it was all right, quite enjoyed it. But I'm amazed. I was in a screening with a lot of people who obviously really like Star Trek, and they seem to be really enjoying it. And I feel like this is one of those films, a really strong one of those films, that in a few years' time we'll look back and go, I wasn't very good.
It's an ITV4 film, basically. Yeah. That's where it's going to live the rest of its life.
Midsummer Murders of film.
It doesn't really lag at any point.
No, at
no point was I bored or thinking, are we near the end yet? Which does happen sometimes when I go to the cinema. I'm like, really? This film's still going? How
really,
is that happening?
But there's no sense of urgency. There's a great lull in the middle when they're in Klingon space and they've already captured John Harrison's character, and there's been an action scene on the Klingon planet where nothing happens, and there's no sense of urgency. We've been told, oh, we're on the edge of Klingon space because the warp drive once again is gone, and we've got to get out of here. And then it just sort of drops. Which, oh, we have time to fly to this meteorite and try this out.
This is rather part of my problem with it, because that is a huge action scene which has been built up and had a huge amount of tension sort of developed around it, and it ends up having, in terms of the wider ramifications of the Star Trek universe, like absolutely no consequences whatsoever, or at least not that I can remember. This is kind of my problem with the film. It left, because I am caught in two minds about it, because I did quite like it at points, but it's just I looked back and went, oh hold on, that didn't go anywhere. Oh hold on, that didn't go anywhere. There are numerous character points and numerous thematic points which are just left twisting in the wind.
And they're quite interesting. At the beginning, there's an idea of before we find out the reality behind the torpedoes that Kirk's mm-hmm. crew are given, we've got the idea of drone attack on this planet that nobody knows anything mm-hmm. about. We've got the corruption within Starfleet. All of these interesting mm-hmm. ideas. And again, I'm not looking for it to stop dead and talk about this stuff. I don't want trade embargoes taught for the first 20 minutes. I want something else there, not simply, well, we'll end it in a foot chase. Because that wouldn't be excusable in something as swashbuckling as Star Wars, and it's certainly not excusable in something that's supposed to be as thought-provoking as Star Trek. It doesn't get the balance right at all. I think that's my problem, Jenny, is it abandons the frequencies the characters are known at, like Spock, who is seen on the poster carrying a gun, a big gun. That's not Spock. And they keep harping on, well, he's half-human. Just drop this half-human nonsense. Have him be an alien. Stop trying to force everybody into being Days of Our Lives characters. I think that's my problem with it.
I wasn't trying to disagree with anything you're saying. I was just trying to promote some of the good things. The world building is really rather lovely.
Yes.
It wakes one character up with an alarm clock he has to hit to turn off. So you have this connection with our time, and it's still there in the future, and you can identify with that kind of, oh, what is that noise? Make it stop. You know, you can sort of see that world developing. You can see how that world can grow out of us. And I thought that was really lovely.
It is
very lovely.
I
thought some of the shots were beautiful. Mm. I'm just trying to promote the things that I liked about the movie without completely...
Yeah.
I'm not undermining any of your points. I agree with you. But I still liked it despite those points that you're making.
you're quite right. I can be too. I don't want to paint everything with the same brush. There are many things to admire, but they're all technical things.
Carl Urban is not a technical thing.
Carl Urban's very good, but again, he's misused. What? Simon Pegg has more to do, but then he's just playing Jar Jar Binks again.
I did think Benedict Cumberbatch in his role was very entertaining. I think that he's kind of underused. I think they should have made more use of him, but I liked that. That was one of the parts of the film that I genuinely liked. I thought he was sort of like, you know, deliciously malevolent. I mean, you know, I did enjoy his role. Albeit, as I say, it's not the best written part, unfortunately. I think he's a little bit wasted, but no, I thought he was very good. I enjoyed watching him in that role.
Owen, you...
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think...
Lean forward,
yeah,
Owen.
Sorry. I absolutely agree. And I think that's also the reason why, for me, actually, that middle section didn't flag as much as it obviously did for you. Because, actually, it is the bit where they... I don't think the writing's very good and stuff like that, but they do slightly go back to that sort of Star Trek idea of talking to people, and you know, it's a very slightly more philosophical piece. It's not very philosophical. I actually had a much bigger issue with the opening, you know, if you like the what you'd call the pre-title sequence, you know, the first bit where they're rescuing Spock. In that, a couple of problems I had with it. One, it's so obviously designed because it's 3D, and I saw it in 2D, but it's just huge kind of. That was the only bit for me that actually really clanged like that. But also, it's Hero, and you know, people who are yellow running through woods that are red, chasing people that are blue, and it just, I was bored for about the first 20 minutes, and I just sort of think you can be bored. Ironically, I don't think being bored is the biggest criticism of the Star Trek film, because you could be not excited by the action, but kind of drawn into a sort of vaguely philosophical, yes, slightly moralizing, but sort of vaguely philosophical ideas. It's a more sort of thinking man's world. But you know, and I absolutely agree with Jenny that the sort of, you can see the progression. It's nice that it's futuristic, but it's not all utter fantasy, and you can see the progression. But that, ironically, there's no progression the other way. There's nothing between that world. You can't see any development into the future of Star Trek and it catching up with the television series that people know and stuff like that. There's no sort of, you know, I mean, they made, I think it was one of the recent Star Trek series, they sort of did a one before, didn't they? You know, before. Yeah. And it that worked better, because you could kind of... I'm amazed there aren't loads of nods to, oh, look what, there's going to become a tricorder or whatever it is, you know, but there isn't.
Well, remember, this is a parallel universe now. That's getting into the...
I think he's just throwing stuff away. I think he's using that as an excuse to make the film he wants to make. Really.
Which in the end turns out to have been Star Wars.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
That's a little bit dismissive. There's some nice, as Jenny said, there's some nice, very nice technical work in it, and the acting's fine across the board, but they're not given anything to do with the exception.
It's still one of the better things Chris Pine's done.
I can't think of anything else he's done except that Denzel Washington, that exactly. Tony Scott film. I know he's Jack Ryan later this year. But anyway, there are things to like, and there's a lot of thematic things to be annoyed and angry about. It's a particularly lazy script, I think, as usual, but good production design. It's a summer blockbuster. Okay. Star Trek Into Darkness opened yesterday and may be tracked down at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It's available to view in either 2D or 3D, and like all the summer, it is a certificate 12A. For the past 15 or so years, Pedro Almodovar's dramatic films have become such prestige releases that it's difficult to recall his breakthrough was with an anarchic comedy. Now, perhaps as a palate cleanser after the bitter melodrama of Broken Embraces and the identity crisis body horror of The Skin I Live In, he's returned to these comedic roots with I'm So Excited, a film that seems, at first glance anyway, to be as inconsequential as possible. Written, as always, by Almodovar, I'm So Excited takes place almost entirely on a flight from Madrid to Mexico City. Even before they've crossed out of Spanish airspace, the plane is in trouble. The landing gear is stuck in an upright position, and the air crew are knocking back drinks with abandon. On board are a clutch of Almodovar regulars playing a series of melodramatic over-the-top characters, the 40-year-old virgin who's also a psychic, a bank manager on the run from the police, a duplicitous Lothario leaving his lovers behind, and a plain-clothes dominatrix with incriminating pictures of both presidents and princes. Each has their secrets, but as the booze flows and the fuel runs out, a stranger's lips loosen and inhibitions fall away. Jim, I'm So Excited has been dismissed by critics who were excited and used to Almodovar delivering something more emotional. And I think The Skin I Live In, his last film, was a masterpiece. So it's coming from a masterpiece for many people. But is there a meaning to this in-flight madness?
There is. I'm not particularly certain that it's come across in the best possible way. I mean, to hear some of the descriptions of it and to even see the trailer, you would think it was kind of, you know, a knockabout sex comedy in the style of some of his earlier stuff. And it is, but there is a lot of subtext running through it. There's a lot of commentary about Spain, Spanish society, the Spanish economy. However, to me, it felt a little bit tacked on. It didn't really work for me, and I, in all honesty, got a little bit bored around the halfway mark, which was extremely disappointing for me, because although it is a completely different type of film, obviously his previous feature, The Skin I Live In, I just thought it was fantastic. I thought it was one of the best films I saw that year. This, however, it's not bad. I just find it a little bit underwhelming. I didn't really find any of the satire that went along with the comedy particularly incisive or effective, and the comedy itself only really raised laughs from me very occasionally, to be perfectly honest.
It's I've always said in the past, Owen, that Almodovar, a bit like Pixar in a way, has a knack of making particularly difficult narrative things appear easy. It's the thing that Evelyn Waugh wrote about P.G. Woodhouse, that P.G. Woodhouse can write people in and out of rooms very easily. And I've always found that about Almodovar. And I wasn't looking forward to I'm So Excited very much, because I didn't think it was going to be narratively very interesting. But he does do things here that I wasn't expecting, and it's not quite as straightforward as the synopsis sets out.
No.
There are nice themes, and there's not in jokes, but there's nice use. I'm thinking of the use of the intercom and the way he makes the most of this space, and indeed the way he uses the passengers and the economy class. And
yeah, I found this a bit difficult because I'm sort of struggling. I quite enjoyed it. It's just mad. I just thought the whole way through, this is mad. I was sat in a screening of this. Quite a lot of people there. It was a later middle-aged couple sat to my left and some young Spanish people sat to my right. And I just spent the whole film going, there's things about this film that both of you groups of people will hate and or could find very difficult. Or it seems a mess. I do actually think, I think you're absolutely right, I think there is some interesting stuff. I think also that it's quite like a stage play. He uses obviously it's a confined space, so that probably helps. But there's quite a lot of sort of stage play writing type stuff going on, and the use of the intercom is clever, although odd and never, you know, there's a sort of, he wants to do this thing with the intercom where everyone can hear what's being said, and so he just goes, oh, by the way, everyone will hear what you say.
Well, it's just the fact just the fact that we suddenly go off into a completely different narrative off the plane, and it's like a story within a parenthesis within parentheses.
Yeah,
suddenly, and I love that. I love the ease with which he pulls that off.
Yeah, I mean, there is this. I did have this odd sense all the way through that he is obviously very talented, and that there's some really quite clever things he's doing that aren't kind of in your face clever, and they sort of work. But I did spend the whole, and I think I probably laughed at it a bit more than Jim. There was bits that I found funny. There was a couple of bits that I thought were genius. I found the cameo at the beginning, the two cameos at the beginning, just bizarre and almost pointless. And but fine, I didn't have. I think my point is about this. I had no problem with any element of this film, apart from actually there's one scene in it, which
we might discuss that if it's the same scene.
Yeah, I think it probably is. Which I think is troubling, but equally, I wasn't actually troubled by it at all. Which is, I think,
it's troubling in retrospect. Well,
yes,
let's talk.
I don't know if it's the one. If it's the one I think you're talking about, I find it pretty troubling at the time. Thank you very much. But
this guessing game is not much fun for our listeners. It's the scene we're talking about. Well, actually, to get there, we'll talk about the sexuality of this film.
Yeah.
First of all, because the three flight stewards. Well, they're originally at the beginning, they're a camp homosexuality, but almost everybody in this film becomes bisexual by the end.
Yes.
And it's dealing with similar themes in a way to The Skin I Live In, where sexuality is fluid once the conventions of life are removed, which seems to be an Almodovar trope, and he plays with that. But it can feel a little bit seedy. It can feel a little bit dated. The camp humour in this is not far removed from
Yeah.
Are you being served?
Yeah. Well, it's not even just that. It's the characters they examine it with. This is obviously just sort of like Pedro Almodovar's particular way of wanting to, you know, examine these things. But let's forget about the female hostesses. We'll knock them out for the entire film. Like, I don't have any interest in telling this through female characters, with the exception
A reason why they're knocked out. The reason why the passengers, this is the economy class that are medicated so heavily, they're not in the film except the sleeping passengers.
No, but I'm talking about like the hostesses.
Yes.
There's no particular reason for that.
I think, well...
Having that happen with economy class passengers, yes, and there is a bit of commentary going along with the fact, as we've said, the subtext that is running through.
They're the Spanish people who are aware of what's going on, yeah.
Perfectly good reason for that. It's just a case of, I don't know, the whole thing just fell a little bit flat for me. I mean, like, in term narratively, I mean, in a director's sense, it's a very good film, but then to a certain extent, and I realise this may be taking filmmakers for granted, Pedro Almodovar is an extremely talented filmmaker, we know that, so I'm not really expecting something which is incompetently directed, in the same way that Star Trek needed more than just action. In order to really make it a good Pedro Almodovar film, it needs more than his... Because he does make, as we've said, very good use of space, and, you know, all the sort of hallmarks we've seen in various other
sublime moments throughout the whole film.
But it needed to mesh together a little bit.
All right, before we wrap up, let's deal with a very serious issue in the last quick hurried minute. There is, and Jenny said this when we reviewed Skin I Live In, and I hadn't thought about it before, but I've been thinking about it a lot since, and I still like this director's work, but that rape is used as a narrative tool. It certainly is in Broken Embraces, in Volva, and in The Skin I Live In. Here there is a character, another Almodovar regular, who is a virgin and is eyeing up the crotches of the male passengers. And she's a lovely character. She's really, really nice and delightfully played, and there's quite a lot going on there. But she eventually she loses her virginity to an aroused but medicated passenger in economy class. Now that's rape. Yes. If it happened the other way around, it would be uncomfortable. He seems to be aware of this because he has a passenger sort of slightly awake and see. And again, it's wonderfully shot and it's brilliant, but it's still the sexuality of it is a little bit concerning. And you only get away with it because it's him, perhaps.
Yes, you say that if it was the other way around, it would be troubling. I think more than that, if it was the other way around, it wouldn't be in the film. I mean, I just don't. I mean,
it wouldn't be in the film for the same purpose.
No, exactly. Yes, it wouldn't be in the film in the way it is. Yeah. No, absolutely. And also, if it had been in the film the way it is, I mean, every news outlet in the country would have been talking about it because it's a rape scene in a knockabout comedy, which has already got three incredibly camp homosexual air stewards. You know, there is some definite, which because he's a talented director, he very nearly gets away with all of it. And I did come out going, it was weird, but I sort of quite enjoyed it. And there's some, you know, like you say, there's some sublime moments. But there's a rape scene. It seems incongruous, and it, for me, ironically, it wasn't as incongruous as it should have been.
You don't really think about it till afterwards.
Yeah, I did a little bit, but I was thinking, and that's one of the things I mean about the people sitting next to me. I just thinking, these people behind me are really uncomfortable at the moment, and they were laughing 5 minutes ago at something, you know, at some people singing along to "I'm So Excited."
I quite like that though. I don't understand
who this film is aimed at, and it really did feel to me a lot of the time like a 70s sex comedy.
There is a little bit Confessions of a Window Cleaner. The best directed episode of Confessions of a Window Cleaner anyway. Oh, we better wrap up. We'll have no time for anything. I'm So Excited opened last week and is screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 15.
Radio that's actually made in Cambridge.
We are community radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
Every second Sunday of the month, tune in to Cambridge 105 for Our Mill Road at 9 p.m. with me, Kerry Ann Littlechild. I'll be covering the latest news and events from Cambridge's most cosmopolitan street here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. I'm Toby Miller, and today in the studio I'm joined by Jenny Colley, Dave Riley, Jim Ross and Owen Baker. In 2011, a depressing, though sadly not surprising, survey revealed that women only made up 19% of writers on British films and only 15% of directors. In the technical disciplines, lighting, editing, sound, etc., the percentage is even lower. Back in March, Cambridge's Watersprite International Student Film Festival invited representatives from the Women in Film and TV organisation to host a panel on the role of women in the creative industries, an opportunity to discover the intricacies of the business and, in particular, the hurdles faced by women. The panel of five women included a fight coordinator, a production designer, an editor, and Gabby Norland, a cinematographer with over 10 years' experience in feature films, documentaries, and music videos. After the session, Bums on Seats regular Sarah McIntosh spoke to Gabby about her work as a cinematographer and how the mentor scheme run by the Women in Film and TV has helped her, and the importance of making sure many more women are among the filmmaking voices being heard. But Sarah began by asking how she became involved with the Women in Film and TV initiative.
Well, I actually got involved with Women in Film and Television because I won a year's free membership. There was a short film that I shot that won Best Cinematography at a film festival that's also a women's crafts film festival called Underwire. And part of the prize was a year's membership. So I became a member of Women in Film and Television. And towards the end of my year of membership, I'd looked at all the events and I hadn't actually managed to go to any. And so I went to a networking event and I discovered that networking wasn't as scary as I thought it was, and that when it's a group of all women, it's actually much friendlier than you think it would be. Then I saw about their mentoring scheme, and I thought that as I was making the step from being a focus puller to a cinematographer, that the mentoring scheme might be very helpful to me. And I applied for the mentoring scheme and got onto it. And that actually included another year of free membership to Women in Film and Television. So I've been very fortunate in that I've had two years of free membership, and they've absolutely, I found them really brilliant.
Why specifically do you think it's important to have women-specific initiatives like this?
One of my fellow mentees made the comment that if there was a Men in Film and Television organisation, it could just be called Film and Television, because at the moment, I think only 5% of fiction directors are women, 4% of cinematographers are women, and 2% of sound recordists are women. So the industry, particularly the technical side, is still quite very male-dominated. So it's very important to support women, because women have a different perspective on storytelling, and after all, storytelling is what filmmaking is all about, whether it's documentary or drama. So it's really important to have balance, male and female viewpoints through the industry.
Do you think it's not necessarily the industry that's sexist so much as that maybe women don't feel like they can do these kinds of jobs?
Yes, I think men quite often have more confidence when they're younger to go out and do these jobs or to give it a go. I certainly noticed that amongst the other people who I was an assistant at the same time as and a runner at the same time as, the men that wanted to be cinematographers moved up and became cinematographers more quickly than the women. And I'm not sure whether... I think that's just that they were more confident in themselves or more impatient. And I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. That's just how it was.
Is there any challenges or advantages that you can think of that being female in the industry entails, or is gender kind of a non-issue once people know your work?
Yeah, well, you'd hope and expect that you're judged purely on the quality of your work, not on whether you're male or female. No, I think every individual is an individual and has a different response to a story or a challenge, The key for me is the relationship with the director. So whether that director is male or female, or whether I'm male or female, it's just a relationship between two people. So it's the quality of that relationship that's really, really important.
Susie talked a bit about peers and tutors that she had through being,
in
the film school and things like that. But a lot of the names she mentioned were men and that. And I guess with this being about women in film and television, I was wondering if there were any female role models that you sort of looked up to or still look up to.
When I was on the Women in Film and Television mentoring scheme, my mentor was Nina Kellgren, BSc, and she is a wonderful cinematographer with a very deep understanding of her craft and excellent skill in communicating and teaching people about that. And I've also been privileged to work with some very excellent female directors who I found very inspiring. But even as an assistant, I found some of the assistants I've worked with and some of the other female DOPs. I recently worked with, I assisted a female DOP called Catherine Derry. When I was a loader, she was a focus puller, and I recently operated on a feature that she was the DOP on. And working with Catherine's always been very inspiring for me because she's very creative, very calm on set, very in control of the situation, all the things that a good DOP, male or female, always is. So she's been great. And I've also been privileged to work with Lynn Ramsey on a couple of occasions, who, is a focus puller and as a B camera operator. And she's incredibly inspiring and just such a positive, creative, forceful figure with such a strong vision. That was absolutely brilliant.
Do you think that attitudes have changed? Whether is it easier now than it was when you started out for women, or is it kind of a myth that it ever was difficult?
When I started, it was reasonably easy for women to start out in film. I don't know whether there are as many women entering the industry, but I think in terms of the camera department, I can see quite clearly that there's probably an almost equal amount of second camera assistants who are female, and then slightly less first camera assistants who are female, and then considerably less camera operators who are female, and then hardly any directors of photography who are female. So it kind of, there seem to be less women as you go up the ranks. So that's the same in business, I believe, that, you know, that as you get to the top levels, there are less women. So that's something that I think probably needs to be addressed across all industries, not just across film. But there has been a lot of talk about there being a celluloid ceiling for women. And all I can say is, if you're starting in film, just don't stop. Keep going and break through the ceiling. Take every opportunity you're given and make the most of it. And don't be afraid to try things and to push yourself forward.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Gabby Norland for sitting down with Sarah after taking part in her Watersprite lecture, and to Watersprite for allowing us access to their speakers over the crowded and hectic 2 days of the festival. You can find out more about Women in Film and TV on their website, www.wftv.org.uk. Whilst Gabby Norland's cinematography work may be seen at her website, www.gabbynorland.co.uk. You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. I'm Toby Miller, and today in the studio I'm joined by Jenny Colley, Dave Riley, Jim Ross and Owen Baker. Following on after us will be Radio Dante, an hour of Italian culture for the Cambridge community, delivered in Italian and then handily translated into English. Saturday Sports Zone is from 3 to 5, followed by Jason Allen, and then at 6 p.m. by the world music of Club Global. That's all to come, but we've still got, as usual, about 22, 23 minutes of the show left. We'll wrap up with a look at Mud, but before that, we're out for revenge.
I am Beatrice.
Victor.
Why'd you follow me?
I wanted to find out more about you. I want to take you somewhere.
I know why you really came tonight. You want to find out if the girl's been watching, you saw what you did. I saw you kill this man. The man who did this to me. I want you to kill him.
The person doing this to me, I want him to know if there's anything left in this world that he still cares about, I'm gonna burn it down.
Thank you.
After his enormously successful adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, it was inevitable that Danish director Neil Arden Oplev would hear the siren call of the Hollywood Hills. After trawling through 200 possible scripts, he eventually settled on Dead Man Down, a thriller with the uneasy moral tone and conflicted characters familiar from his breakthrough hit. The film also finds Oplev reuniting with the original Lisbeth Salander, Noomi Rapace, herself testing the waters of big-budget American films. Rapace replays Beatrice, a woman cast adrift from the world after a drunk driver scarred her face in an accident. From her apartment window, she spies on her neighbour Victor, a mob enforcer played with typical brooding intensity by Colin Farrell. When she witnesses Victor kill a man, she decides to blackmail him into murdering the driver responsible for her ruined appearance. But Victor is already consumed by his own plans for revenge. Dave, Dead Man Down aspires to be a little more than your average thriller. The script by Joel Wyman plays with themes and offers an unusually layered approach to the concept of what, if this was law-abiding citizen, for example, would just be simply violent revenge.
Yeah, it was a good film. I came out, you know, I sat through it, I enjoyed myself. The trouble was, because it's trying to do, as you said, both the thriller but also have these layers to it, it kept falling between the gap, if you will, between the two. It was trying to go into one territory where it could unite them both, but it was firmly kind of in one or the other. And as a result of that, it was at times unintentionally quite funny, which ruined it a little bit for me, although I did still enjoy it.
It's not helped by the general... It's a very serious film. It's got po-facedness that's missing from Star Trek, I think. But they borrowed it. It's not helped because for the first 40 minutes or so, it's actually quite unconventional and interesting, and it's mysterious and you don't know what's going on. But that's lent a humorous edge because Colin Farrell, who doesn't talk for a great deal of the opening, always looks confused as well, as if he's slightly lost in his own film.
Yeah.
But it falls down on so many levels, especially from the second act onwards.
Pick a note. Go on.
I should pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The core of the story is the romance between Beatrice, between Noomi Rapace's character and Colin Farrell's character. If you don't, the revenge is secondary to that. But if you don't buy the romance, the film doesn't work. But I didn't buy the romance because the character she's playing is not particularly nice.
Yeah,
and she's self-interested in a way.
They were both really damaged, and it was like,
well, she was far more damaged than she should have been.
Mental and physical as well. Yeah, but it was just kind of. Are you sure you should actually, you know, team up with this person or start a relationship with them? Because you're both horrible for each other and you want to do horrible things to a lot of other people. This, I know, it was just like, there's no way this could end well. I mean, okay, the film proved me wrong for a given definition of end well. It felt like a missed opportunity.
Well, they don't go far enough in what they... Because she's had her the right side of her face rebuilt after this car accident we don't witness. But she's... Obviously, it's horrible, but she's not scarred enough. Because they realise... It sounds awful, but because they realise they want to have a romance between their two leads, she's not disfigured. She's simply scarred. I think that's the best way of putting it.
It's there's all no reason on the top of the surface.
They've had to make the superficial damage mean more by making her a beautician. And then when Colin Farrell's character says halfway through, when she says, "What's your story?" and he says, "Well, my whole family was brutally murdered by Albanian gangsters, and I'm getting my revenge." She then turns around and she has the audacity to compare their problems. Yeah. She's still fine. She's still alive. She's mildly scarred, and because she's so.
Talk about other people. Talk about Terrence Howard.
I think because we haven't got very long on this, and it's not playing enough for us that it doesn't warrant the attention.
No,
it's on Nights all this week, I believe, at Cineworld. But it doesn't have the courage of its convictions, not simply in how it treats its character Beatrice. But it wants to be saying interesting things about revenge and what's left after revenge and the pointlessness of revenge. And it goes a little bit that way with Noomi Rapace's character in The Driver She Once Killed, that he's just beaten up. But even then the film pulls its punches in that he's already, the driver's drunk again. So we don't feel bad about him being beaten up. And then she has to be kidnapped by the gangsters and she's not part of that plot at all. So Colin Farrell, who's been quiet Colin Farrell through all of this film, can go berserk.
Rage
put
monster.
On a book and turn into Gerald Butler and Law Abiding Citizen. It wants to have its cake and eat it. It wants to say things about revenge, but it wants a big gunfight at the end. It's a film based around untruths and misconceptions and idiotic yeah. themes.
Well, one bright side though, Dominic Cooper was quite good.
He is Dominic Cooper, yeah. and
Terence Howard didn't have a lot to do, but
Terrence
he was
Howard
all right.
does. It's a fantastic cast. There's Abraham in a small role.
Yeah,
and Isabel Hubert is in it as well as yeah. playing Noomi Rapace's mother. They're all great.
They just didn't have anything to do.
It's yeah. just a piece of junk.
Good film, but yeah, good film, but yeah, take it or leave it. Really, is the way to sum it up.
Colin Farrell's good as he usually is in these quiet sort of roles. He's yeah. very, very.
And then he goes a bit mad.
He goes stupid. Turns into a typical stock Hollywood blockbuster after spending the first hour pretending it's something else yeah. and wanting to be something else. All right, how are we dealt with that? Right, Dead Man Down opened last week and is screening at the Cineworld Multiplex, though only in the evening. It is a certificate 15. Still only in his early 30s, American writer-director Jeff Nichols has shown a considerable talent for blue-collar characters and a knack for audacious and unusual storytelling. His last film, Take Shelter, boldly linked depression, both mental and economic, whilst his newest film, Mud, released yesterday, recasts Tom Sawyer as a lovelorn teenager. Mud opens with an adventure, as 14-year-old best friends Neckbone, played by Jacob Lofland, and Ellis, played by Tyle Sheridan, risk the swollen Mississippi in order to visit an island with a secret. Here, trapped high in a tree, is a boat, a happenstance hideaway left by floodwaters. But to the boys' disappointment, the makeshift home already has an occupant, Matthew McConaughey's languid hobo known only as Mud. Whilst Neckbone is suspicious of Mud and the pistol he has tucked into the back of his jeans, the more thoughtful Ellis is intrigued by his arm-length snake tattoo, his cowboy boots, and his mournful tale of waiting for his childhood sweetheart, Juniper, played by Reese Witherspoon.
You know that guy? I've never seen him before.
What'd you say, boys?
You got crosses in your heels.
Nails, shaped like crosses.
What for?
Ward off evil spirits. I'm waiting on my girlfriend. She got these birds tattooed on her hands here. Nightingales. Good luck, birds.
I just can't spend the rest of my life running away with him.
She don't care about nobody but herself. Ain't stuck off in that island because of her.
Ma'am, have you seen this man?
No, sir.
Son, have you?
What do you do?
This river brings a lot of trash down. You gotta know what's worth keeping and what's worth letting go.
You never said your name.
Mud. You can call me Mud.
It's a hell of a thing, ain't it? It's a hell of a thing.
Oh, and the rites of passage tale of teenage boys in American culture from Catcher in the Rye to Huck Finn and onwards seems almost a touchstone for every new American artist. It's a tale they must tell. But Mud does at least seem to offer a slightly different take on this familiar story.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed this. So sort of cards on the table to start with. I think there's a number of things that I really liked about it. I think it is an interesting retelling of a slightly familiar story. But there's a number of things it does brilliantly. Almost every character, and this is not a spoiler anyway, almost every character in this film is sort of good. And that's really rare. Even the bad guys in this film are kind of, they're not good, but they're motivated by a sort of an almost noble cause. The acting is just really very, very good. I mean, I know Matthew McConaughey's on something of a sort of an ascent in terms of his critical acclaim for him recently, but he's really good in it. I think he plays this kind of childlike, slightly lost soul in this worldly wise sort of environment really well. I loved that almost all of the characters, there's a really telling thing in this, that the father of one of the boys, I certainly felt for a lot of the early on, he's going to turn out to be a sort of semi-alcoholic, wife-beating, you know.
But it's not a cynical film in that way at all.
But he's not like that at all. I mean, he must tell his son he loves him a dozen times in this film, and he's just the last character in any film you'd expect to do that. And it's beautifully handled. It's beautifully acted. The two young boys in it are just, they handle it perfectly. I mean, there's not a moment of the sort of your suspension of disbelief being broken at all. It reminded me in a lot of ways of Beasts of the Southern Wild. There's a lot of sort of thematic similarities, and also obviously sort of location similarities, but it did, and I really liked that film, but this for me did it in this in an even more beautifully subtle way. There was no point at which the director, which I didn't realise he was the writer as well, ever went for the simple option. You know, even in the relationship, there's a sort of secondary relationship with the between one of the boys and a girl in the town, and even that, there's a kind of, it's never made the sort of core of it, and yet it's important. And the thing I really want to say about it, I loved the way that it captures that idea of when you're a child and summer's stretching out forever. It's actually all takes place in really quite a short time, and yet it feels kind of like an endless summer. And there's this, I thought it was really beautiful, really beautiful.
Jenny, I wasn't going to start on this question with you because it seems a bit unfair, but don't worry. Is that it could be. It's a very good film, I agree with Owen, but there could be claims that it's slightly misogynist in the way it treats the women in the film. The teenage sweetheart that our young hero has is wavering in her loyalties, and the mother of the family, you say the father tells the son he loves him constantly. The mother doesn't have a proper speaking part until later in the film, and Juniper is as Matthew McConaughey.
Blink and you miss it, really.
Will attract the eye of any man she can. That's all deliberate. Is that okay in a film like this? Really, when to have that sort of. Because after all, it is from the point of view of the men, and the women are allowed to be not simplistic, but are allowed to be more mythologized like this.
I think mythologized is a really good word. It's not a film that's from the point of view of men. It's from the point of view of two 14-year-old boys.
And a man-child. I would suggest that the point of view turns to mud. It muds in the second half, and he's a man-child in many respects. But sorry, carry on.
And I think for them, they don't understand women and relationships at all. Right at the beginning of the movie, one of them recommends a book to the other one to try and help him understand how to talk to women and how women think. And it's just a book about being more confident, I think. But it's quite sweet, the little relationship that the two of them have and the way they kind of, they look at women and they're a bit scared of them and they don't really know how to interact with them, how their brains work. And so I don't think it's this kind of overtly misogynistic film. I think it's a film that shows how confusing it is at that age to interact with anything outside of your social circle, which for them is the two of them. They have this very easy, very loving relationship, and they don't quite get how everybody else works, because for them it's easy to talk to each other and then it's hard to talk to everybody else. I think the film is basically all about love, which is kind of adorable in how...
And unusual,
It is, very much so. And without being too overt either. It's not saccharine. It just wears its heart on its sleeve and, you know, and talks about how relationships happen and how love can be sort of parental and fraternal and romantic and sexual. And it's all the different aspects of love and misunderstandings of love and how love is not a cure-all. You know, that you can love somebody and it still not work. And it's kind of very sweet, I think.
But saying all of that, and I agree with you, and for the most part, the film treads that line perfectly. But a bit like Take Shelter, it sort of seems to fall apart for me anyway in the third act, or at least the final act. The explanation that Jenny's just given makes it sound like it's going to end more lyrically, not happily, or poetically, but more lyrically than it does. And I felt disappointed. It sort of, we won't go into specific details, but it turns into what the director has termed a sort of Sam Peckinpah ending. Yeah. It's not gratuitous, but I felt it was too conventional.
Yeah, I think there's some truth there. I think it loses some of its liltingness, particularly at the end as well, I think. But I was so happy to be drawn into this world, and it just quickly, one of the other things I really liked about it was that it's this other world. It's again, it's very much like Beast of Southern Wild. It's showing this other world which is kind of a bit lost in time and probably a bit doomed. The father actually says at one point, this life's not much longer going to exist, kind of thing, and they're living on the river and stuff. And yet at no point does it say these people, you know, there's one time where the boy says, I couldn't cope in the town. But you know he could, and it doesn't make out that this world is so utterly different and divergent from normal life. It just sort of says, this is the life they live, it's a bit different, and it makes them a bit different, but it's not a huge problem. I do agree with you that the ending is a compromise.
But is there a danger in the because it uses visuals that our hero, our young hero, can't see, and it uses one particular visual we won't go into. That's nobody can see, and it's a lie. I don't understand the one shot in particular towards the end.
Yes, I agree.
I fear it tread a little bit too much. To go back to the mythologizing comment, it tread a little bit too much into the area of Place Beyond the Pines, where men were unknowable creatures, and it simplified things a little bit too much. Yeah. It became too dangerously became alt country.
I think there's a tiny bit of truth in that, but I think that the thing that undercuts that enormously and is so rare in I mean any mainstream film really now is that the men, yes, they are a little bit unknowable, but they're also, all of them really, are so open about this idea of love. And you know, even Matthew McConaughey's character, who's obviously an incredibly flawed character, and like you say, he's a man child and all of that, even he in the end, or all the way through really, gets that what he's doing is conflicted and difficult, and yet he has this kind of love for these people who've shown him a bit of love, I suppose. And I was prepared to go with it because it doesn't give in to all of the kind of simplification of an ending. And I was really swept up in it. I really enjoyed it. So I was prepared to forgive it, those things. And I didn't really even have to think about forgiving it. I just did. I was quite happy. I came out and was like, there is a bit of a problem with the ending. But it wasn't worried about it, to be honest.
Jenny, I've not had enough of you on the show today. What would you... to sum it up, it's and go back to what Owen said, really, it's a perfect... It's many things, but it's also a perfect evocation of that cusp of adulthood. But it's not adulthood that's brought about, as it usually is in these films, by violence or by loss. And it's treatment of love, I think, that it's marks it out.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting movie. It's very accessible. I mean, I think Owen's compared it to Beasts of the Southern Wild, which I completely agree with, but it's a much more accessible version of that. And I thought it was just really very enjoyable and a bit of a breath of fresh air in Hollywood cinema nowadays.
That's not American cinema.
American cinema, yes,
certainly. Okay, well, thank you very much. Mud opened yesterday and is screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 12A and it is well worth seeing, and on as big a screen as you can, as Mississippi Vistas. And that, once again, is all we have time for today. The last hour of discussion and debate will be available in a few days as a Cambridge 105 podcast, downloadable or streamable from the www.cambridge105.fm site. And don't forget, you can drop us a line via Bummers on Seats on Cambridge 105, or you can find us on Facebook and you can find us on Twitter. We'll be back on May the 25th when Mark Liversidge will be making his bow as programme host. Among the films up for review will be Baz Luhrmann's much, much anticipated 3D spectacular of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. The excellent French director Oliver Assayas, who made Summer Hours and Carlos, returns with the counterculture drama Something in the Air. And Vin Diesel, Paul Walker and Dwayne Johnson all resist saying, "I'm too old for this shift," as they reconvene for Fast and the Furious 6. Sadly, earlier this week, the hugely influential special effects artist Ray Harryhausen passed away, leaving behind a bestiary of monster masterpieces and some of the most iconic scenes in cinema. We'll play out with the Cyclops theme from 1958's Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, which perfectly captures the majesty that is so terrifying to a child and so evocative to an adult. Please stay tuned for Radio Dante, but from all of us here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.